everyone, and welcome back to Murder in the North. I'm Kelby.
And I'm Zach.
And before we get into Zach's episode this week, we just wanted to remind everyone that if you're not following us already, we do have a TikTok and an Instagram page. Both of them are at Murder in the North Podcast.
Our case sources are CBC, Murderpedia, Indigenous Foundation Arts, UBC. Our case this week is on Lulanda Fleet. Lulanda was born in 1971 in Norway House, Manitoba, but would live in St. Theresa Point, First Nation. During this time, St. Theresa Point actually only had a doctor visit the island once a month. This is why they would have to travel off the island to have, in this case, Lulanda. St. Theresa Point during this time only had 521 houses on the reserve, and only 460 of them would actually have running water. And the food prices on the reservation were actually 50% higher than the retail prices, and still are.
That's just insane.
It's like, I don't understand how that can be allowed to have them that high.
Yeah, well, even today, a lot of reserves don't have access to clean drinking water, so that's still consistent in 2022.
It's a really good point. So Lulanda's mom would actually work as a community healthcare worker, and her dad would actually just work like odd jobs just here and there. But her parents drank and actually struggled with their alcohol addiction. And at times her dad would actually go on binges in Winnipeg that would last up to a month at times.
Oh, geez.
And the worst part about it, sometimes her mom joined. So they would actually get passed on to another family member to watch them for the time that the parents were gone.
Yeah, that's so sad.
With the drinking, their parents would also throw parties. And Lulanda's oldest sister during these parties would actually lock the kids in the basement away from the adults. Because as soon as the party would start to die down, the violence would start to begin. And they would start to have fights. Fights would break out kind of outside and everything. So what they were doing was trying to kind of keep the kids safe and not get into anything.
Keep them separate. Yeah, exactly. No, that makes sense. That's good on the big sister to do that.
I was actually really like impressed when I saw that.
Yeah, it's also unfortunate though that she has to take on that role.
Exactly. But when Lulanda was around 10 years old, she would actually start to be abused by one of her older relatives. It didn't really state what kind of abuse, just abuse. She would bring it up to her mom, but she wouldn't believe her. So this is when she would actually bring it up to her aunt, who also wouldn't believe her.
Oh my God.
Around this time, this is when she actually had to suppress it and keep it to herself, because no matter who she told, they wouldn't believe her.
Oh, that just riles me up.
Seriously. And especially in a case like this, like, if you have someone, like a kid that's coming to you explaining this to you, and you're not doing anything, you are failing that kid.
Absolutely.
You should be doing what you can to make sure that whatever is happening gets resolved, and there is a good outcome for what is happening there.
Yeah, you should believe them.
Exactly.
Yeah, you shouldn't say, yeah, no. I could talk all day about this.
So to this day, the abuser has actually tried to reach out to her to apologize for what has happened, but she's told him to never talk to her again, and they were never charged for what happened. And I don't think anything has really been brought up to the mom so much, because Lulanda actually didn't want to ruin the relationship. Her mom's now 75, so she didn't want to ruin that relationship kind of within the family.
Yeah, I mean, rightfully so for her not wanting to speak to them anymore.
Yeah.
That's good for her for setting that boundary.
No, and that's, at least somebody is.
Yeah.
So around 14 years old, she would actually be sent to a residential school in Tooling, Manitoba, which is near Winnipeg. For the people who don't know what a residential school is, it was a school system that was set up by the Canadian government and was mainly run by the churches, and their main objective was to try to have a good kind of education for the Indigenous kids, But unfortunately, in most cases, from what we're kind of hearing nowadays, it wasn't so much the case. And actually turned out a lot of them were actually being taken away from their indigenous heritage. And we've actually, in Canada, have seen a lot more kind of light coming to a lot of the issues that were surrounding residential schools. And I believe they were actually shut down in, I want to say, was late 1990s.
I believe it was like 1998 or something, similar to the year we were born. Yeah. But not only that, like residential schools, they're being talked about a lot more, but there was a lot of abuse that happened there.
A lot of abuse.
Malnourishment. They tried to make these schools seem like it was really awesome, but it really wasn't. It was a place where there was assimilation, and like you said, they were literally stripping kids from their heritage. They were told that being Indigenous was not right, and that basically being white is the way to go. You need to be quote-unquote civilized, because they saw Indigenous people as being not civilized.
And I hate to kind of quote it here, but my grandfather actually like wrote a book called Alice, and he actually talks about the main character is in a residential school, and actually talks about like going from a reserve to a residential school, and the changes that they had to make to essentially please the administrators there.
Yeah. It's honestly a really sad time in Canadian history, and thankfully we're talking about it now, but still it doesn't make up for all of the trauma that these individuals have had to face.
Exactly. So with Lalonde actually moving to be at this school, she actually at this time didn't even actually speak English. During this time, she was actually speaking OG Cree and would actually have to learn how to speak English to be like to kind of really achieve within the school.
Yeah, that would be hard.
Yeah, and it was during this that she actually did really well in school and actually was enjoying school and kind of going there.
From what I've been told, too, English is one of the hardest languages to learn, if not the hardest language to learn, just from all, like, the slang and, like, the grammar and things like that.
A, E, I, O, and sometimes U.
I before E, except after C or something.
Oh. I still don't even know. But during this time, like, she was actually going to school every day. She wasn't missing any days. And a doctor would actually say that it was good for them because it would get them away from the chaos at home. But Lulanda's sister would say the opposite, as we kind of have seen a lot of cases happening. And she would actually say that they would have a lot of comments thrown at them. One in particular saying to go back to the bush where they belong. Like, it's some of the I can't believe, like, how people can just throw comments out like that.
Racist.
Seriously. So, fast forwarding to when Lulanda was around 15 to 16 years old, she would meet a man named Brian. And from what I can find about Brian, he wasn't the best influence on her. He was the one who influenced her to have her first drink. And this relationship would actually lead to her getting pregnant. So she was pregnant around like that 15 to 16 range.
Okay.
She would keep the baby and would have the baby in Winnipeg, which is about an hour away from the school, and actually had family, like her relatives, that were in Brandon, and they would actually take the baby so she could return back to school for grade 11. But at this point, the drinking had actually become too much, and it would actually lead her to move back to St. Teresa Point First Nation. She wanted to finish school and get a job to become a nurse, but being a mom had its own challenges. Lulanda was a single mom until she was about 18. This is when she would meet her future husband. So just to kind of give you a little bit of a notice here, we don't actually have the name of the husband. I wasn't able to find that. And any other kind of men that may get mentioned, we don't have any names, so it might get a little confusing, but I'll try to kind of keep it easy. When she met her husband, he seemed like a great guy. They would end up having 5 kids together and would actually end up living in an island-like community. He seemed like the perfect guy, but things would later come into light when she turned 22. This is when he would force her to drink with him, and this is when he would actually lead her to drinking. They call it a super juice, but it was a homebrew. They would start smoking marijuana, and this actually led to crack cocaine. All of the substance used between the two would actually lead to her husband becoming abusive, sexually, physically, and emotionally. And to top it off, he was cheating on her at the time. To be like, I'm going to do this to you in our house, but then I'm going to disrespect you more by going with another lady. Yeah.
I can't understand why people are the way they are.
Seriously. And like how they think that's just okay. So this husband would actually lock her in the house, take her shoes, and also remove the phone so she couldn't contact anyone or run away.
What the heck? Yeah, that's a little abusive.
I don't know about you, but I would do what I could without the shoes.
Yeah, and seriously.
Just go. And just take off.
Yeah. That's so sad.
On top of this, there was actually reports of being beaten with objects, as well as being burnt by cigarettes. Lulanda's husband one night would actually start assaulting her, and would actually end up dragging her across a rough patch in the ground. And I didn't see any reports on how, but the police were called. And this husband would actually end up spending 6 months in prison. But when he got out, he went back to the same house and started living with Lulanda again. And at this time, the abuse only got worse. We see this in many cases because she would actually, at this point, start to leave. And it began in that cycle that we see. I'm sorry, I won't do it again. Okay, I'll take you back. Starts happening and she'll leave again. And that constant cycle kept going until she would actually break it up and she would move back to St. Teresa Point First Nation.
Did she take the kids with her?
Yes, she did.
Okay.
Moving back, she was able to acquire her certificates in home care support and first aid. But one old habit stayed with her, the drinking. And now, with all the abuse, it has gotten worse. The drinking would begin to spiral, as Lulanda, at this time, had never actually claimed federal benefits for her kids. So she would be handed a $14,000 check.
And she probably spent a lot of it on alcohol.
So she actually would use the money to move her and her kids to Winnipeg. But this is actually when she would meet a new man. And a good thing about this new man was he's actually from St. Teresa Point as well. But he was there on a drinking binge, just like her father used to do.
Okay.
So it was during this time that they actually were getting along very well. He wasn't beating her, wasn't calling her names, and was actually there for her. So after a little bit, they actually moved back to St. Teresa Point. And she was actually using the money that was coming in for the kids to help her mom actually re-renovate the house and try to kind of get things back going there. And with the boyfriend, he didn't have a job. So he was always asking for money, borrowing money from family, and also kind of, he was, and I don't like using this term, but kind of panhandling, like kind of asking for money on the streets.
Oh, okay.
And with this kind of time, this would actually lead to him to start stealing money from Lulanda.
Oh, I was waiting for the butt.
Yep. And this was the butt. So Lulanda around this time was actually moved in with him. And he would start to kind of see it as their money because she didn't have her own address. And she was living with them.
Okay. I'm trying to think about where this case is going, because right now I don't know.
It isn't one of our typical cases that we do, to be completely honest with you.
Huh.
So with them kind of living together, with him kind of making some of the financial decisions, this is when they would start to spend a lot more money on alcohol and would start drinking more. And during this time, her kids would actually start urging her to take it easy, as she would later be hospitalized for withdrawals. I believe that she was trying to quit, but due to the amount of drinking, the withdrawals really kind of got the best of her.
Yeah, from my experience and what I've been told as well, like not personally, but like in my field that I work with, alcohol is one of the hardest drugs to withdraw from, because you can have seizures, like you get tremors. So you really have to be cautious and really watch the person that's coming off of it. And even still give them like a little bit of alcohol to like slowly wean them off. You can't, like, you can't go cold turkey if you drink that much. You know what I mean?
For sure. And it was actually when she got back, she went on another drinking binge. And during this drinking binge, someone called Child Protective Services on her. This led her to lose all of her kids and have them taken away. One would move in with her aunt, two with her mom, and the other ones were actually sent back to the dad. And she fought to have them not go back to the dad because of what they went through with the dad. But they still went back. As you could guess, this just led to more drinking. Because during this time, she would actually express of how alone and depressed that she would feel, and angry for her losing her kids. She would actually even say she didn't care about herself anymore. And kind of at this point, I just want to stop and say, if anyone is listening to this and may kind of be anywhere near this point, we just want to both say to seek some professional help, just so you, because you don't need to be kind of in this dark place.
I think it's very common, especially for the indigenous populations, not only from the residential schools, but the other trauma that she's faced, she's clearly drinking to help manage those underlying traumas.
So at this point in time, she was actually start to drink around a 26-ounce bottle a day. So for some of us, we know it as like a 2.6.
Yeah, oh my goodness.
And this would be until her mom would actually call the cops on her because of her behavior one night at her rooming house. So rooming house, like there's a bunch of different, like almost apartments in the house, essentially. Yeah.
So was she still doing crack cocaine or was it mostly just alcohol?
I believe at this point was just alcohol.
Okay.
So this argument would later, would continue later. And this would actually lead to Lalonda going into a rage and would actually set fire to a couch that was on their on the front porch of the house. And with the fire being at the front door, this would block the entrance and the exit. And this fire would actually cause the death of five people.
Oh, geez.
And police would later find out about who did it and would find Lalonda. Would find her at a bar and was arrested and actually told her what she'd done. Up to this point, she had no idea that anyone died.
But like, why did she think that was a good idea?
Seriously.
Yeah.
And from what I can almost see, it almost looked like as an intimidation or scare tactic towards the boyfriend's mom, because it was actually the boyfriend's mom's house that she said it to.
That makes sense, yeah.
But I, from what still, I can see, she wasn't actually in the house. So she would find out about the five people that died. These people's, the names of the people were Norman Darius Anderson, Maureen Claire Harper, Kenneth Bradley Montgum, Dean James Strandom, Robert Curtis, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce this, Lafont. Norman was only 22 years old when this happened.
It's just really unfortunate that they were innocent people.
They were just living their lives in their house. So Lalonda would go to trial and she would plead guilty to what she had done. She would get a life sentence on account of 5 manslaughter charges because she never meant to do it. She never meant to kill anybody.
At least she took accountability and pled guilty.
And so because at this point, with the drinking being so heavily, it actually went to say that she remembered being at the address and doing something but didn't know what.
She just was kind of past that point.
Yeah, she would even go on to say that her life essentially was wake up, drink, blackout, do it again.
Yes, and I totally understand that was her reality and everything, yeah, but she still killed 5 people who were innocent people, right?
Yeah.
I don't want our listeners to be like, we're taking, you know what I mean? Like, what she did was okay.
Yeah. So, with her being charged, she is now living in a women's correction facility that's just outside of Winnipeg, where she is sentenced to life. She was actually, the way that she was sentenced, it's like one manslaughter charge after another. So she would serve one, and then another one, and then another one.
Gotcha.
She would actually receive a letter from Norman's mom about kind of everything. And she would actually say, "I often think about you and wonder how you must be feeling. I am writing you this, letting you know I am not mad or angry with you, that in that I love you, even though I never met you. It is really hard for me to think about this person that I have loved so much, that was taken away from me so suddenly. I pray that things will go well for you in court, and I do not want to lay charges, but it's not up to me to make that decision. I want you to know that I want to put this behind me and move on with this in my life. God bless you and take care."
That's nice that the mom wrote her.
Yeah. And this is currently where the case is still sitting. And she's still behind bars.
So she'll probably be there for most of her life,
you'd yeah.
say? Yeah.
I do believe that she does have the possibility of parole. From what I saw, it was around 2011 that this happened. And it was about 2000. And then she was actually... she pled guilty in October of 2012. I saw something saying that she was up for parole after 5 years, but I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But from what I could find, she is still behind bars at this point.
Okay. That was interesting.
And it's definitely a different case. That's why I kind of wanted to go about this route, because it's something else that we kind of... that still happens, and definitely kind of... it's hard because she definitely had a rough life. There's no doubt about that, but in the end, she did still take the life of 5 innocent people, right, for something that she did during one of her drinking binges.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel researching this, being Indigenous?
It's tough because a lot of people have a stigma kind of towards people that live on the reserve that essentially they are drunks.
Yeah.
And, like, I know you've kind of seen it with our family. Like, that's not the case at all in our family. But
it's definitely a stereotype.
Yeah. And, as you've already kind of said before, a lot of places don't even have the running water. So,
there's lots of barriers for Indigenous communities in general.
There's a lot of barriers for sure. And it seems like...
and intergenerational trauma that they faced in result of the residential schools that was by the government.
Yeah. So it's, researching this one, it's hard because it seems like a case where, yeah, it seems like she was almost dealt the hand and a lot of the things were against her.
Yeah.
But that is the case of Lulonda Fleet. As Kelby said, we will be posting this on our Instagram, and we should be posting this on our TikTok as well. So please be sure to go over and follow us. It's Murder in the North podcast for both, and we'll see you guys next Tuesday. Thank you and stay safe.